So good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, David.
We are back checking in on the current events on a weekly basis. And if what was happening in the Middle East was not a big enough conversation, which is still going on, and we do appreciate everybody's comments, both about the Egypt piece and the Libya piece. And we actually may get to some of the things that came up for us as we read some of those comments. So just everybody out there know we are reading them, and we find it fascinating what is coming up for all of you. So today we're going to take on this really little subject, which is about the economics of the planet. On this question, when we look at economics on a global scale, and even if we pull it into what's happening in this country right now, which is this big debate about the budget, federal budget. And so there's this tendency to want to dive into the detail and say, all right, so what do you think of this? Or what do you think of that? Do you think we ought to leave the funding in place for the weather service, or do you you know, and you get into all that, and you quickly get into this Gordian knot that gets very, a lot of polarities come up, and then these two sides start fighting with each other over a particular thing. And really, from an integral view, what you constantly remind me of is that sometimes it's good to step back and sort of look at more of the meta and really ask this question is, Are we managing the details here? Because there is a point where you have to make decisions, even in our own lives, like if, in our own financial things. Is we watch our budgets if we do. We make adjustments. We notice that maybe we got to pay that bill versus this. But if you're in real financial trouble, then the first thing a counselor is going to tell you is that radical change is going. You're going to have to really get to the heart of something, like can you live in the house that you're living? I mean, something major, right?
Right.
So I guess that's the question that we're holding today. Is this just business as usual, the two sides fight it out over the budget, or given not only what's happening in the United States but in the world, are there global patterns here that are suggesting that something deeper, more radical needs to happen, and then how do we hold all of that?
Well, the integral view gives you these meta perspectives and meta contexts. And if you look at the planet as a whole and the economic forces that are working the planet, there are basically three big forces online. One is a pre-modern. This is tribal economics. This is patronage. This is seen as corruption by the levels of modernity and post-modernity. But this is, I'll scratch your back, you scratch my back. This is most of human history.
And it usually means that the people at the top have the majority of the resources, right? Isn't that usually?
Well, when you look at how hunters and gatherers did it, no. It was like you know, they did it in a very egalitarian way. And then, of course, as societies continue to structure it, then absolutely.
Right. Then the king
you have
in
the king who has right. everything, that 1% has everything.
Right.
And then there's the whole sea of, you know, humanity. And, you know, we've worked our way out of that. But one of the ways we, you know, the basic principle of that, which is non-zero sum interactions. This is the basic of economics. It's where two people get together and what they create together is greater than the sum of the parts that they could create alone. It's as simple as that. And that's the basic lever of economics, whether it's like I figure out that you give me some bear skins and I'll give you some arrowheads and we'll take it from there. And that continues to be the force of how human beings interact and create wealth. And so so we have that pre-modern. And they're, you know, wanting to move into modern, more or less. There's lots of problems there. And we're seeing them in the Middle East, and we'll continue to see them and work with them globally in Africa, Afghanistan. There's places around the world that are still in that meme. The bigger memes that are really working and struggling with each other right now are modern and postmodern. So modernist is the basically the corporate meme. This is the meme of free enterprise. This is the memes of globalization. It's the memes of science, industrialization, all of that stuff that brought to us as a species spectacularly tangible results, in the words of Daniel Dennett. And that is that we, you know, tripled lifespans. We created the indoors. You know, just stop for a minute and think, what is it to live where you actually are, you know, free from the vicissitudes of the weather?
Well, like you that we have enough calories. We were sitting down at dinner the other night, you know, doing a little prayer for the thing and all the rest of it. And I just added that. I mean, because we just so take it for granted that we're actually sitting at a table with a huge amount of calories.
Yes.
that we take for granted.
This is one of the, you know, we see it as a great, horrible downside of our lifestyle is obesity and diabetes. Mm-hmm. And it's all true, and there's horrible things. But it's just a remarkable achievement of humanity that our biggest problem with calories now is we have too many of them. You know, for most of the vast, 99% of human history, it was a search for calories. So you can see, you know, if you want to look at a hockey stick graph, it's the wealth of humanity in the last 200 years, you know, since the Industrial Revolution. So that is the modernist growth model. And it has been remarkably successful. It continues to be remarkably successful. We're now approaching 7 billion people on the planet. We have what Jeffrey Sachs calls the bottom billion still. These are the people, the billion people who are still living in abject poverty that we need to pay greater attention to, and we need to help as a more developed world. We need to help these people move into modernity. And, of course, we've been quite successful at that. In the last 20 years in India and China alone, a billion people have moved out of poverty into something that's better. So this growth model is very, very powerful and very, very good at creating wealth. And this is an acquisition of humanity that we need to take seriously and appreciate. And yet we see, and this is the next stage of development, is postmodernity. All kinds of red flags and alarm bells go off at this growth model because we see that if we have the continued mining and drilling and polluting, the resource depletion, the idea that as the rest of the world develops into modernity, that they're going to use resources at the level that people in the developed world are currently using them, it's just untenable. And so there is a huge reaction against modernity that comes online in postmodernity, and you know, the green meme, we would call it, and it's green politically and so forth. It brings all of ecology and empathy for the poor, and you know, all of those, you know, more or less 60s vibes that came online have a very, very important piece of the truth. That the growth model, as it's currently being advocated for among conservatives, and you know, if we look at, you know, basic politics, the conservatives are more the modernists, the business types, and the liberals are more the progressives and, you know, liberals.
Yeah, and let's not forget the human factor, because one of the things as we go into postmodern, as we come into this larger circle of care, we start to see that in spite of the advances that we've taken advantage of to even have the time to even have these discussions, it means that we have enough calories, we have a roof over our head, we have an economic system that provides abundance and way more abundance in this country than others. But we then also start to see as sort of that modern bottom line sort of thinking, who does it exploit? And you raise, you know, it potentially exploits the planet, but also people. And certainly one of the issues right now in this country, and has been for a while, is jobs, in quotes, going overseas. Well, why are they going overseas? Well, because the cost is much less. And sometimes that's a good thing for the people that are there. And other times when we really dig into it, you say, no, they're actually exploiting people in sweatshops. And that's what this grand company is making all their money off of, and, you know, living the high life running around the world. We see a certain outrage arise in us and say, that's not right, to build our abundance on the backs of people that have nothing.
Absolutely. And what you're talking about, I think, is the next stage of development, an integral stage of development, where we have the orientation that we're going to be friendly to the engine of modernity and respectful of its ability to create wealth, health, decency, entertainment, education, medicine, watts, bushels per acre, all, you know, all of the stuff that it delivers in droves, and respect and protect that, and also bring a new view to it, which is the postmodern green view that says, and that has to happen in a way that is respectful of cultures. It has to happen in a way that is respectful and sustainable to the earth, where 80% of the fish in the ocean aren't depleted, where we're not poisoning ourselves. We're doing it in a way that is sustainable. Well, and that's one of the hopeful things about having this evolutionary view, because you realize, and you see it, and we see it in our own lives, that there's a realization that comes at some point that material wealth is, you know, you have to have a certain amount of it. But beyond that, it doesn't increase happiness. In fact, there's studies that show, and one of the, I forget his name, but he was a Nobel Prize winning economist at Princeton, who did a huge research study on happiness that showed that people are happy, people's happiness increase, and we're using American dollars here, until about $70,000 a year in income. After that, happiness doesn't increase. And so it actually points to that there is a sort of an intrinsic level of material wealth that is required, and no more. And in the sacred world to come, we will have worked our way into the actual practice of that, in my opinion. But in the meantime, we, you know, certainly have some work to do. Because the other piece of his research that was interesting was that there's another piece of happiness that is also in play in it, and that is, how does one feel like one is comparing to other people in their community? And so this is where you hit one of the big hot buttons of one of the big issues, one of the big real problems that we're facing in the developed world. I think in general, I'm not so sure in every country it's equal, but in the United States it's a big problem, and that is inequality of wealth distribution. And the fact that we have seen top 1% of Americans now own 1/3 of the net worth, and the top 10% have 2/3 of the net worth, and the bottom 30% don't have much of anything. And that's untenable. That's just sort of intrinsically, there's going to be a force that wants to correct that. And so, you know, this is part of the struggle that we see in American politics.
When you say untenable, though, that doesn't mean that it couldn't go on. Just that we're going to suggest, as you just did, that there actually is a force that over history tends to want to equalize. So
eventually,
if you actually make the people standing outside the castle, life's bad enough.
Yeah.
No matter how many weapons you have, no matter how oppressive you be, they eventually storm the castle and basically string you up.
And that happened every single time. If you look at recent history, since modernity, the rich have gotten richer, no doubt about it. But the poor have gotten richer at a higher rate, actually.
Some have.
And that's still not good enough. Right. It's one of the issues now in American politics. Actually, if you look at the budget, it's complicated and there's some things that are difficult for sure, but it's actually not that difficult to fix Social Security, for instance. Social Security would be fixed tomorrow if we had means testing. That is, that people who make a certain amount of money either get stepped down or at some point you just don't get your Social Security check. No problem. Well, big problem politically. But easy enough fix, and I think it's one that eventually, you know, we're going to come to, but it's going to be bloody politically to get there.
I love these little graphs, right? Because one of the things that we sort of hold in the back of our minds is that we think that this budget process is actually talking about 100% of what we spend, theoretically, right? It's saying, all right, so we're going to have a budget, right? And so everything's on the table. But when you actually look at least in the given system now, and this is really one of the questions that's up that's coming out of the Tea Party, is can you continue to muck about with, because here are the percentages, right? So Social Security, you just mentioned, right, is 21% of the total federal budget. So if you're not willing to go into and do something like you just said, make some adjustment that politically may not even be doable, where it's some sort of judge about whether you need it or don't need it, then you just took 21% off the table. And even then, we think the Social Security system is going to bust itself because of all the baby boomer. Medicare, Medicaid, another 21%. Defense and security, another 22%. Now, that is a variable, and it does vary, goes up and down as we buy weapons, don't buy weapons, and all the rest of that. 9% is the safe, what they call the safety net programs, which are, you know, just at the bottom end, food stamps and all the rest of that. 9% is just the interest on the debt. Everything else, besides that, 18%. Right. So when you say, what can you really get to the discretionary income? What can you really have a conversation about? You're not talking about 100% of the budget, unless, and this is really what the Tea Party is raising, they're saying, look, you're not going to get there by screwing around with the 18%. You can have this conversation all day long. But if you leave all those other major pieces without touching them in certain sort of sense, then what you really need is do radical cuts and start getting rid of whole programs and all the rest of it. I saw a guy on the other night, the Tea Party favorite that came out of the straw poll, somebody we don't even know, who's a businessman. I get it. And he said, this is what you would do in business. You don't muck around the edges. You basically start eliminating programs. Totally. But the question is, if you start doing that at a federal level and the U.S. level, then what really happens?
Well, you get killed. Yeah. That's what happens. And so that's why we don't do it and haven't done it. But you're absolutely right. 18% of the budget is, when we talk about these budget battles that we've all been hearing so much about, you know, Planned Parenthood and PBS and all of this stuff. And so that becomes very political, and the conservatives want to cut their the programs they hate, and the Democrats want to, actually they don't want to cut much of anything, fair enough, because, you know, education, infrastructure, and let's just make sure that we're making the point that this, we're talking about the federal budget
federal
here.
Budget.
That's what we're talking about. So there's a movement here. So everybody knows. I mean, we have the Deficit Commission. They all agreed. There was Republicans. There was Democrats. Simpson, Bowles. You know, we have to cut these entitlements or, you know, reform them. We have to cut the fence. And we have to, you know, reform Social Security. Well, it's easy enough to do with Social Security. Again, maybe raising the retirement age, that's on the table. Certainly means testing, and this we'll fight this out politically and see which of these two have to happen, or some combination of the two. With defense, America has to get real about being an empire and being the world's 911 and being, you know, and using military force to deal with problems that are better dealt with soft power. We're learning all of that. I mentioned in the last conversation the remarkable statements by Robert Gates about, you know, anybody who invades with an army needs to get their head examined. The debate that's going on around the no-fly zone in Libya, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they were talking about it last night.
I'm thrilled to see that Europeans are in on that discussion, and America can't continue to be the cop of the world and, you know, the bully of the world. So we have to get real on that. In terms of Medicare and Medicaid, the medical system, I'm not sure whether the Obama program will help it or not, but there's a certain disconnect between people getting procedures and knowing what they cost that probably has to be fixed. Now, Obama says that his program will, and the CBO seems to agree to, you know, some degree. We'll see about that, but that has to happen too. So these aren't, you know, they're just a matter of getting real. The American people, and this is why my answer was, when you said, so what happens when people try to deal with this? My answer was they get killed.
Right.
Because the American people haven't gotten real about them yet. And we probably have to have more pain. And maybe, I hope not, but maybe some kind of stupid, unnecessary meltdown again. Where you're talking about, you know, China calling the debt or whatever, that kind of thing. I don't think that's
going to
happen.
All the apocalyptic theories.
All the apocalyptic economic theories. I don't see them happening simply because the world at this point, in a good way, everybody has their hands on each other's throat.
When you go to the global system, a lot of the discussions from certain quarters is still about the United States being king of the world, which we have been since the Second World War. We were the last one standing. And we also helped out everybody. I mean, we did a lot of stuff, but we all. But what we got out of that is that we're the dominating force. I mean, and there was Russia, but then they went away as well, right? So even then, even more so. So the question is, we look at China, and I hear people say, well, you know, they're are they going to challenge us? Are they going to be the next one? And you kind of go, well, I mean, certainly they're coming on. So is India and all the rest of it. But does that, still talking about this like it's some competition between nation states, who's going to rule the world? Which has been going on for at least 300 years in this version of it. And the real question then when you get to postmodern and integral is that we see the global world system and say, no, it's actually all interconnected. Why do you think China's not calling the debt? Because it's in dollars. And if they do that, the theory is, this is going to track right back to them. And they're smart enough to say,
exactly,
we're actually all interconnected.
We have, you know, we talk about world government and all of this stuff as if it's some future fantasy. Well, the fact is that we just we have in many ways de facto world government. I mean, we're so intertwined with few little outliers in various parts of the world, but there's a huge consensus around the basic ideas of modernity. China's going to do it their way. India's doing it their way. The Middle East, once they break free into modernity, they'll do it their way. Europe's doing it their way. But modernity has basic principles of basically world centrism and, you know, a world economic system. And so, you know, we talk about the problems in America, and yeah, there's a huge problem with inequality that needs to be, you know, remedied. There's a big problem of debt. But what's not a problem that you hear all the time is that America is falling behind or America is no longer number one. It's true. It's not.
Not in the way that it's been.
But so what? Yeah. You know, what's happened is America continues to grow and improve in many, many ways. It's just that the world is catching up. And so, you know, I'll probably get some criticism for this. I hear that American students are 29th in math or whatever. I'd like them to be higher. I think we could improve our education radically, absolutely. But is that a big problem for me when I consider that there are, you know, now 80, 90 countries that are basically have modern education systems? Right. You know, so what? And so what with a lot of these things? There's a certain American pride and exceptionalism. The British had it. You know, that it's what empires do, and it's what we need to get hip to.
Right.
And so that we don't go the way of empires in the past where it's just you can't see your own faults and you can't work your way out of your debt problems, right, which every empire ends up with, right, because they overextend.
Right. So if I'm, you know, I'm listening to this, I can just imagine the audience going, oh, my God, how do you get your hands around this problem? And but most importantly, what do I do? I mean, where do I put my support? What should I celebrate? What should I be concerned about? And then the question then that we're kind of walking around the edges is that, and the claim that we make from Integral, is that Integral actually allows us to be a bit more hopeful than the polarized conversation that takes place between postmodern and modern. And now when we say this, I just want to be really clear, is that you and I are not dumb enough to say those are two distinct discussions. It's useful to take a look at right. those things. And nowhere was this clearer. Was the other night I was watching Matt Damon, who's got a new movie coming out. He's being interviewed by a British journalist. And somehow the question came up is, what do you think about the healthcare thing? And Matt Damon, who is a liberal and basically supported Obama, said, you know, it's really interesting. I actually called up Republican strategists that I know. And because I'm Matt Damon, I could get him to come to breakfast with me, right? He laughed about that. Uh-huh. And he said, we sat down and because I really wanted to understand how there could be, what he wasn't calling it this, but how could there could be a reconciling force between these two positions? That nobody's happy with this healthcare bill. It's one of those compromises where you sort of got something through, but nobody's happy with it.
It's a start.
To a certain extent. So he says, you know what I found out? He said, here's the deal. This is what I found out. He believes, the Republican strategist, that healthcare is a privilege. And I believe that healthcare is a right. Even though sometimes people can claim that Integral's really simplistic about it, there is the modern and postmodern
right.
attitude.
Right.
Is that modern says, no, you don't automatically get this. You got to work right. for it. Right. And only those that can afford it right, right. actually get it. Because right. why? You're lazy if you're not getting it. Postmodern says, no, actually, healthcare in a country this rich is something that we ought to be providing everybody across the board. But what was interesting to me was that the British guy then says, you know, this is the thing that we don't understand in Europe, is that we look at you guys and we say, you're the richest country in the world. In Europe, our healthcare is provided free to everybody. Now, as he says that, you can say, well, there are problems with that system too.
Right.
But he said, it's just mind-boggling to me that the United States wouldn't be at a place of saying, one of the things about being a United States citizen and paying your taxes and all the rest of it is that you actually get health care.
Yeah. Well, you look at this and it seems hopeless. And, you know, the British have their system and the Canadians and us. And, you know, there's all these arguments back and forth of which is better. I get lost, mm-hmm. you know, in some of those arguments. But I have a greater sort of trust that this continues to be the fruit of a non-zero interactions that we have with each other, is that at this stage of the game in the world, what we're after is really just to get more and more smart mm-hmm. about these things. Mm-hmm. And people are hip to that. I mean, the elites, the people who are running the show, there's a lot of force to just make things more and more efficient, bring the best ideas of this system. It's an ugly process. It's sausage making all the way through. But I just have faith that we'll continue to get more and more intelligent about these things, and that we will absolutely grow into, as we move into a center of gravity, postmodern and beyond, that basic health care, of course, is a right. And a right not only of every American, but of every human being. And of every animal is what we'll see at some point. You know, I'll get a little airy-fairy here, but the sacred world to come, you know, if we don't, you know, completely go off the rails, and I actually don't think we will. The big problems, we used to think it was overpopulation. What we see is that when cultures move into modernity, their reproduction rate falls radically to around 2 per woman. 2 children per woman, which is replacement rate. And many cultures fall below that. Japan, Italy, some of the northern European countries. So, you know, we think this is United Nations projections. We'll hit just probably short of 10 billion people. We're going towards 7 billion right now. We can, as a more integrated, intelligent world, economic system, which we will continue to build bridges to each other and continue to help poorer countries, and so forth, we will have the ability to feed that those people, create a standard of living that is roughly equal to what a $70,000 in the West lifestyle is. So there's people's basic needs are met. If you look at the trajectory of history, human beings have always created systems that are more capable and resilient. And at some point, they become more humane. Modernity, you know, the end of slavery, the end of child labor, is still lots of problems. Postmodernity fixes some of those problems, tries to. Unfortunately, modernism and postmodernism hate each other in the process. They completely think together as deluded, co-opted, evil. But, you know, there you go. As an integralist, we see that despite the screaming heads that we see around our dinner tables and our television and the cable news shows, there's an intelligence that is available once to befriend all of those perspectives and see which piece of the truth they bring to the party so that we can continue to create a more humane world with better safety nets for everybody, where there's a sense of equality that brings that happiness that where we realize that we're a human family. And we're doing that. There's a lot that's amazingly right with the world and where it's going. And as integralists, I think we need to, as a practice, notice that. And so that we can, you know, provide some sort of an engine against the postmodern despair that is the characteristic of so much of leading edge consciousness.
So that reconciling force that we claim that at least integral can see the different positions. So we wouldn't be Matt Damon before that conversation saying, I don't understand why we're having such a problem about this conversation about healthcare. Now, there may be a lot of problems in the details, but ultimately, if you those two worldviews that he expressed, you know, that he learned, right, that he said the right versus privilege, if you're coming from those worldviews, it's very difficult to get to the details because it basically is a different informing force.
Absolutely.
It's basically you're saying, well, the truth to me is, is this is actually a privilege. So no, I'm not agreeing with you that it's a right. And the other people are saying, well, how could you be so heartless, right? So the question then is, that seems hopeless. I mean, it seems hopeless. So then when Integral comes into the party and says, all right, we can see those two things, and that's useful to sort out. But then again, what's the reconciling? I mean, I keep using that because what is the reconciling force? Not compromise, not this balance of polarities where nobody's happy walking away from the table because it just does, and usually the solution that has come up with that way doesn't meet the problem. It just simply puts it off for another couple of years. So do you have a thought about where that goes?
It goes where evolution always goes. It includes and transcends. This is the engine of evolution. Is that everybody's trying to improve their lot. This is from hunter-gatherers on up. And actually that selfishness, although we can see the ugliness of it and the short-sightedness of it and all of the arguments that we have, we can also see the evolutionary potency of it because it's what continues to work up the froth that keeps us moving forward.
One of the interesting themes that I went out and looked at a variety of sources online, not just the mainstream media, there were some interesting things. One was that there wasn't much disagreement about that something needed to be done with both the financial industry and the oil industry in terms of not just its tax breaks, but also its regulation. Because we look at 2008 and we go, what the hell happened there? And you go, somebody wasn't watching as all these new derivatives were created. And as a result, lots of wealth got created for a few people and crashed the system. That's really simplistic, but there is that complaint. Oil's the same way. You know, I'm sitting here going, you know, there's just something fishy about the fact that Saudi Arabia can up their quota to cover what's not coming out of Libya. And yet we've watched gas prices in 2 weeks go 35 cents a gallon that I feel every time I go to the pump. So here was the interesting thing is there was some support on both sides of the aisle for there ought to be some other kind of regulation. Now you can make an argument whether it's at the Fed level, or the state level or whatever. But there was agreement that we ought to do something about that because we don't want to be blindsided by that again. And yet when you go to the federal budget, what are the Republicans suggesting in their cuts? And I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying, look at it. They're actually taking a lot of the money out for the regulatory agencies that would need to staff up to do the very thing they're talking about. We notice this in our own lives. If you focus on one thing, right, and you and I have a disagreement about what coffee we're buying, that, yes, that can be a conversation, but it's part of a larger system that if we don't look at the interlocking pieces, we actually, in the course of that one conversation, what we usually say is there were unexpected results of whatever decision that happened to be. So we solved it. We got cheaper coffee, right? That helped the budget, but then it caused some other problems that we couldn't foresee because it's an interlocking system. It's not just the one thing. Yeah. So this is one of the things that seems really complicated to me, at least when I look at this thing, and I'm even hearing it in our conversation today, is how do you even get in on this conversation individually, other than having a variety of vague opinions, which we can all have about what we should do?
Well, that's where Integral comes in handy. Mm-hmm. I mean, because we realize we're not looking, Integralists aren't looking for the perfect solution to anything. I mean, I may have some idea of, you know, what the world's going to look like in a few hundred years, and it's going to be great, whatever. But in the meantime, I think it's going to be a free-for-all for a long time. I think it's going to be a lot of first-tier memes fighting each other. Of course it is, you know. And if you look at the political landscape, the liberals versus the conservatives in our country, for sure. Liberals, the postmodernist, green sensibility, they have a natural antipathy towards the corporate world. They see its rapacious, selfish, mindless, exploitative nature. That's all true. That's an accurate view. It's not a complete view by any means, but it's an accurate view. Then you have conservatives who basically have a natural antipathy towards government. And if you look evolutionarily, conservatives, if you look at the blue-amber meme and the red meme, government has never been the friend of the common person.
Yes.
You know, the king came and took whatever he wanted, from your daughter to your grain to your cows.
Right.
There's a natural antipathy. You know, maybe theocracies are okay and, you know, religious, but especially when you move into modernity, there's a get your hands off of me kind of a feeling about government. So you have these two worldviews, one who hates government, one who hates the corporate world establishment, and you know, they're duking it out. Now, as an integralist, we notice that. We see that that's the way it should be. You know, that's evolution. And because these people are in a struggle, new and better ideas come to the fore. Now, there's mistakes. You know, one side gets too much. It's interesting to see how, particularly in America, anybody gets too much power, they, you know, vote in the opposition. The solutions to the big problems like inequality and debt, and also, of course, all of the ecological problems are going to require bipartisan solutions. They just are. So these people have to be fighting it out. As integralists, we look at it and try not to get too mad at anybody. We try to see that everybody has a piece of the truth, that even though they demonize each other, we don't want to demonize either of them. They both have a perspective that gets to be there and gets to be part of the conversation. Right. Otherwise, it's not democratic. Right. So we have to accommodate these things.
So this is going to be the source of many other conversations. And I would ask the audience to, you know, educate us. If you've got views on this, if this is your big thing, bring it in and we'll go take a look at it and make it part of the next conversation.
What fun.
Yes. So thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, David.